miss a beat. Next year we bail them out, and they're still making $100 million. Nobody's going to come to Sioux City. Why should we send our hard-earned money to New York to bail these big banks out? But the Republicans voted for it. So did the Democrats. They all kind of came together and said, oh, well, we have to do something. They threw up their hands and did it. But nobody really thought about how we got into the fix. We had a housing crisis. I kind of knew something was wrong when the guy across the street sold his house and moved two down, sold it for twice as much, and then moved two houses down. When the guy across the street from you buys and sells a house in your neighborhood four times, each time doubling his money, something's gone crazy. But we got out and we said, oh, well, how did this happen? People said, well, it was greed and envy and self-interest that caused this. Well, people have always been greedy and self-interested. They all of a sudden become more greedy and self-interested in 2007. People said, well, home prices have always gone up. From 1937 all the way through the present, home prices had gone up. And they said they'll go up forever. Well, in 2007, we discovered they wouldn't go up forever, and something was wrong. Something was wrong because prices were doubling and tripling, but nobody really had an explanation. And it's sort of like passing the buck to say, oh, it was greed or self-interest that caused it. Unless you're going to assume that everybody all of a sudden out of the blue became greedy. Perhaps it had something to do with the Federal Reserve keeping the price of interest at close to zero year in and year out. See, interest is the price of money. And most people will tell you that we shouldn't have price controls, because if you have prices freely fluctuating, that's how goods get distributed in capitalism. But then these same people will say, well, but it's okay for the Federal Reserve to keep the interest rates at nearly zero, which is, again, once again, where they are now. But what happens is you don't get the feedback loop. In medicine, we call this homeostasis. When you eat a big meal, your blood sugar rises, and then insulin rises, and your blood sugar comes back down. And in an economy, it's the same way. As the economy heats up and more people are trying to build houses, let's say there were 10 home builders in Sioux City, then there was 100 home builders, and more houses were being built, there should be more and more demand for the money, because everybody's wanting to borrow money. When there's more demand for something, the price should go up. But if you don't allow the price to go up, you don't get the correction. And so typically the economy will do this, but you have to allow the free fluctuation of interest rates. But we fixed interest rates, so nobody got any feedback and everybody kept building houses. If interest rates are still zero and everybody can borrow money easily, just keep building and building houses until we had way too many and there was a collapse. Right now we're still keeping interest rates at zero, and the boom isn't in housing this time, but it may well be a boom in the stock market. What happens when people come to the realization that maybe we've overinflated the stock market again? But it comes from this understanding, this expectation that we want a government that is going to be in control and manipulate the marketplace. Why does government want your interest rates to be zero? Because they have this enormous debt we've accumulated. You have an $18 trillion debt. We borrow $1 million a minute. People say, oh, we can just do that forever. I don't think so. I think there'll be a day of reckoning. The thing is, borrowing $1 million a minute, many economists are saying this is why the job market is so tight. Some say this burden of debt is costing us 1 million jobs a year. And so we have to ask ourselves, can we do it forever? And then some people say, well, where would you cut? How would we cut spending? Well, maybe we could start with just not sending money to countries that hate us. Wouldn't that be a good place to start? Oh. I'm thinking countries, we could start with countries that burn our flag, countries that chant death to America, and maybe we shouldn't send them a penny. Maybe we should stop it completely. If you ask people in Iowa, should we borrow money from China to send it to Pakistan? Should we be building roads and bridges and schools in Pakistan, or roads and bridges and schools in our country? I think most people would agree with me. It makes no sense to borrow money from China to send it to Pakistan. But if you ask them in Congress, and this is how out of touch they are, this is the argument for term limits. If you ask them in Washington, is it a good idea to borrow money from China to send it to Pakistan, almost every one of them says yes. If you ask all the other Republican candidates, there's maybe one or two other than myself who believes that you shouldn't be borrowing money and sending it to other countries. So I had an amendment, and I put it forward in the Foreign Relations Committee. My amendment said that we should not send money to countries that persecute Christians, countries that put to death Christians or put them in prison for life. And you say, well, who does that? Well, it was about 25 or 30 countries that practice primarily Sharia law, and they actually do, if you have interfaith marriage, marry someone from another faith, if someone converts from Islam to Christianity, or if someone says something that they say goes against the religion of Islam, it's life sentence in prison and or death. Asia Bibi is a woman who lives in Pakistan, and she went to draw water from a well in a small village. And as she was drawing water from the well, the women of the village gathered around her and men, began stoning her and chanting, "Death to the Christian." She was stoned and beating with sticks, lying, bleeding on the ground, yelling for help. When help finally arrives, she thinks she's being saved. She was arrested. She's been in prison now for 5 years, and she's on death row because the women of the village said that she was a blasphemer, that she had said something against Islam. In our country, we'd call that hearsay, and no one would ever go to prison for an accusation about what you believe or who you are. But we continue to pour billions of dollars into Pakistan, billions of dollars into Afghanistan. And there has to be an end point. We have to ask ourselves, when will it end? Will it end when we're completely bankrupt? Some in Washington say, well, that's how we project power. We're going to project our power around the world and let them know who America is. I don't think you project power from bankruptcy court. I think you show your weakness by borrowing more and more money and spreading it across the world. The other thing is it sometimes is counterproductive. People say, well, we have to be there. We have to be over there. They'll be over here. For example, in Libya, Hillary's war in Libya, good idea or bad idea? Here's the thing. We topple Gaddafi. Was he a bad guy? Yeah, he was a secular dictator, a secular autocrat. We topple Gaddafi. But you know what came? Chaos. Out of the chaos came radical Islam. A third of Libya now pledges allegiance to ISIS. What do the neoconservatives in our party say? They say their only objection to Obama's policy is he didn't do enough. So he intervened and we got involved in the war in Libya. The neoconservatives in our party just say, oh, well, we should have sent troops. If we had only sent troops to Libya and Nigeria and Syria and Iraq and Iran, where does it end? We have to borrow money from China to fund these things. We're out of money. It's making us weaker as a country, and sometimes it actually makes it more dangerous. So, for example, Syria, we had a vote in the same committee on whether or not we should fund and send money overseas. We had the same vote again in Syria on whether we should arm Syria. When I said that I put forward an amendment on whether or not we should send money to countries that persecute Christians, I lost 18-2. Every Democrat and almost every Republican voted to continue sending money to overseas to these countries that persecute Christians. So another amendment came forward in the same committee, and this was over to whether to send arms to the Syrian rebels. And they said, oh, we're only sending them to the moderates. One CIA analyst responded to that. He said, you know, the only thing moderate about the Syrian rebels is their ability to fight. And I told him, the great irony is you're going to send these weapons to the Syrian rebels, and the irony is we'll be back within a year to fight against our own weapons. And that's the irony. That's where we are now. Most of these weapons were either snatched up directly or maybe given inadvertently to the wrong people. The ambassador from Syria came before our committee. And he was asked about, well, will any of these weapons be going to allies of Al-Qaeda? And he said, well, it's inevitable that the people we are funding will be fighting alongside Al-Qaeda. This is before they were called ISIS, or before the radical jihadists formed a new group called ISIS. But the inevitability is we were sending weapons into Syria, into this misbegotten civil war, with bad people on both sides of it, with people who hate us on both sides of the war. But we sent weapons in, so people are fighting in a trench. Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, and ultimately people who became ISIS are fighting alongside the same people we are giving weapons to. It absolutely makes no sense at all. There are 2 million Christians that live in Syria. More Christians live in Syria, in the Middle East, than any other place other than Egypt. There's a lot of Coptic Christians in Egypt. But Syria has 2 million Christians. If you ask them, if everybody here were a Syrian Christian, you ask them, who would you rather have in charge of your country, Assad or ISIS? Every one of them says Assad. Is he a good guy? No. Is he a guy that any of us would vote for? No. Should we arm Assad? No. But we certainly shouldn't be arming the people fighting Assad. As we armed the people to fight Assad, we degraded Assad and created a space and created this chaotic region out of which ISIS grew. There's a little town called Malula in Syria. They speak Aramaic there, the language that Jesus spoke. As the marauding Islamic rebels, I don't know if we funded this particular group or not, but we funded the allies of this group, as they came into Malula chanting death to the Christian, a young man stood up by the name of Zarkis el-Zakim, and he said, "I am a Christian, and if you must kill me, do it." These were his last words as he became a martyr. We have to think before we act. For goodness sakes, which side are we on? The Syrian rebels, the ones we were funding, not one of them likes our country. Not one of them likes Israel. There's 1,500 different groups fighting Assad. Not one of them would recognize Israel. In fact, the people fighting on the side of the Syrian rebels, one of them that we gave anti-tank weapons to, said that when they're done with Assad, they're going to take back the Golan Heights from Israel. Why in the world are we in the middle of this civil war? Maybe there is no good side sometimes to a civil war. But if there's one thing we should learn from the mess of the Middle East, one thing we should learn and know is that every time we've toppled a secular strongman, we've gotten chaos and we've gotten the rise of radical Islam. We are more at risk to be attacked right now from Libya than we were when Gaddafi was there. The Iraq War. Some don't want to face this because it occurred under a Republican administration. But the thing is that Iran is stronger now because Hussein is gone. Hussein was like Assad, not a good guy. But the thing is Hussein was a counterbalance to Iran. They fought a war for 8 years. 500,000 people died in the war, and they were somewhat at a stalemate. But with Hussein gone, Iran is now made Iraq a vassal state. Iranian troops are in fact, they're the ones fighting in Iraq now. Iraq may not be repairable. You may not be able to put Iraq back together because the Shiite government in Baghdad has pushed out all the Sunnis. So ISIS comes into the Sunni cities, and the people say, who do we hate worse? The Shiites who have been fighting for 1,000 years, or these people who are of the same brand of religion. Now, I think they may have made a mistake, and they may discover ISIS is worse than the Shiites, but that's the problem. Could we go back and win those cities back? Yes. But at what cost to our soldiers and to our lives? And the thing is the people who live there don't want to fight. You know, are we to fight everybody's battle for them? I've somewhat flippantly said if we want to send something new to the Iraqi army, it should be tearaway uniforms, so when they run, they can tear their uniforms off faster. There are people over there who will fight, though. The Kurds will fight. The Kurds will fight. In fact, I'd offer them a homeland. And I wouldn't send the weapons to Baghdad. I'd send the weapons directly to the Kurds. There are ways that we can help the people who live there, and we do have to do something to protect ourselves from being attacked. One of the things I've spent a lot of time is talking about Hillary Clinton and her failure in Benghazi. And it wasn't just that night failing to defend the embassy. It was for 9 months leading up to the battle in Benghazi and the assassination. Is she just kept sending people home that should have been defending the embassy. When we do have an embassy, we do have to defend it. That's part of the reason why I've said Kurdistan has an embassy or a consulate or a Erbil. We need to defend that, make sure we're not overrun. In the spring before the ambassador was assassinated, there were couple of different groups of special forces, not many. There were two groups of six. One was taken out in February because it seems there was this sort of politically correct nature that Hillary Clinton and her kind of people didn't want to show the Libyans that we thought that you had to use guns to protect them. So we didn't want to show any guns because these were freedom fighters. We didn't want to offend the freedom fighters, some of whom actually were in prison in Baghdad and other places as members of Al-Qaeda before we started calling them freedom fighters. The people who won the war in Libya to defeat Gaddafi were radical jihadists. Libya's a jihadist wonderland now. I mean, it's gone from a place that had a little bit of stability to where the jihadists swim in our swimming pool, our embassy fled, our ambassador was killed. But what I fault Hillary Clinton for is just continuing to bring home the forces that were there, small forces, but some forces that were there to defend the embassy. So in the spring, as she's bringing home these special forces, there's a request from the ambassador. They want to have a DC-3 plane to fly around the country in time of a crisis, to be able to leave if they had to. Hillary Clinton denied this request. But about 3 days after she denied the request, she did approve $100,000 for a charging station. $100,000 for a charging station for the embassy in Vienna. Seems that our ambassador there was greening it up and wanted to brag to the Europeans about how green he was, and he had ordered all these Chevy Volts. Of course, you paid for all the Chevy Volts because they're all heavily subsidized. So they had like a fleet of 24 Chevy Volts, but they dawned on them they didn't have the right plug. So the same week that Hillary Clinton denied a plane to fly around in Libya to try to escape from danger, she approved $100,000 for a charging station for special plugs for Chevy Volts in Vienna. Also about this time, Hillary Clinton approved $100,000 for a tour where we sent three comedians to India. It's called the Make Chai Not War Tour. That was a real useful bit of money. She spent $650,000 on Facebook ads for the State Department. So while denying security and saying she didn't have enough money for security, she spent $650,000 on Facebook ads. Seems the State Department Facebook doesn't have enough friends. So they're advertising for friends. Hillary Clinton spent $700,000 on landscaping for the Brussels embassy. They spent $5 million for crystal barware and glassware for the State Department embassies. Meanwhile, didn't seem to have enough to do anything for Benghazi. You get to August, and there's a 16-man personnel team left defending the ambassador. That's it. They put all the other special forces have been brought home because we don't want the Libyans to be offended by us wearing weapons when we're guarding the embassy. So they're all brought home. There's a 16-man team led by Colonel Wood. And you may have seen him interviewed on television. He kept saying, we need to stay. There's a danger that the embassy will be overrun. They're brought home. There's cable after cable from the ambassador directly to Hillary Clinton saying, we need more help. We need security here. And so after the ambassador was killed, Hillary Clinton came before my committee and they investigated this. And I got to ask her a question. And I asked her, Secretary Clinton, did you read any of the cables? Any of the cables pleading for help, did you read any of these cables? And she's like, oh, no, no, I was traveling and that's someone else's job. And that, you know, she couldn't be bothered. It was one of the most dangerous countries in the world. And she couldn't be bothered with reading the cables from the ambassador. So what I've said, and I'll say again today, is that if you're not willing to step up and defend American interests, you're not willing to step up and defend our embassies, then by all means, it should forever preclude Hillary Clinton from ever holding higher office. If we want to win as a party, we've got to figure out how to win Iowa, not just the primary. We've got to figure out how to win the general election. We lost Iowa twice to President Obama. We lost New Hampshire twice. People talk about you guys being early primary states, but you're also purple states. You're states that were not winning in the general election. Colorado's another one. Pennsylvania, Ohio. These are five states all won by President Obama, and Republicans have had trouble winning. Right now, I'm the only Republican that beats Hillary Clinton in all five of those states. I think the reason for that is I'm a little different than the other Republicans. I'm somebody who believes that we need to be the party of the entire Bill of Rights. All 55 Republicans who will come before you who are running for president will probably tell you they're for the Second Amendment. Many of them are probably pretty good on the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. So am I. We have to be a party of the entire Bill of Rights. The Fourth Amendment's about the right to be left alone. The Fourth Amendment says the government can't look at your records unless they have suspicion, unless they write your name on a warrant, they have individualized suspicion as to something you've done wrong, and a judge must sign the warrant. But there's nothing in the Constitution that would allow the government to collect all your phone records all the time. In fact, even the courts have said this. The court looked at the question, and the court said that there's nothing that justifies the general collection of all of our phone records. And some people say, well, who cares? If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. It's not about whether you have something to hide. It's about whether or not you should be left alone, whether it's your religious life, whether you're an evangelical Christian, whether you're someone who teaches your kids at home, whether it's somebody who has beliefs that are unorthodox and you just think it's none of the government's business. It really is none of the government's business. But in this race, there are very few Republicans. In fact, Jeb Bush has said, you know what, I think the best thing I like about President Obama is his program to collect all of our phone records. I think that's completely tone deaf. If you interview people under the age of 40, 83% of those under 40 think the government went too far in collecting our records. Just Republicans in general, over half of Republicans think the government went too far in collecting our records. And some say, well, how will we catch terrorists if we can't look at everybody's records? Put the name on a warrant. I want to look more at the records of terrorists. In fact, I think we get so distracted by everybody else's records that we're not spending enough time looking at the records of potential terrorists. There's not one case of anybody we've discovered through this bulk collection of records. Everybody that we've discovered so far, someone has tipped us off. The Russians tipped us off about the Boston bombers a couple years in advance. Why didn't we pay any attention when one of them flew back to Chechnya? I'm all for looking at the records of people we have suspicion. I don't care how deep you go into it. But many have said that we have information overload now. That the more information we collect, the less we understand it. So that we can actually do a better job if we're more specific in the way we go after terrorists. But there is a question, though. How are we going to win? Some say we should dilute our values, that our party should become more like the Democrats, that we need to be Democrat-like in order to win. I couldn't disagree more. I think we need to be boldly for what we are for. We were once the party that believed in cutting taxes. I remember as a kid, I went to the 1976 convention as a kid when my family was supporting Ronald Reagan. But he was pretty darn clear about it. We need to cut taxes, leave more money with the people, and that's how jobs will be created. But in Washington, half the people in Washington are for revenue-neutral tax reform. That means half of you pay more, half of you pay a little less, and the net result is zero. I tell people, if that's what we're for, I'm going home. I've got better things to do. But the thing is, let's be boldly for cutting taxes, and let's explain to people why people in Iowa would do better if you left more money in Iowa. I mean, it's as simple as that. We leave more money here. So I looked at the tax code, and I said, can we fix it? It's 70,000 pages long. I don't think it can be fixed. I said, let's scrap the whole thing and start over. So I've proposed a flat tax, 14.5% for personal income tax, 14.5% for the business tax. Right now, the corporate income tax is 35%. We're chasing jobs overseas. Jobs and companies are reincorporating and leaving America because the taxes are too high, the regulations are too high. It's hard to do business. Our tax would be the lowest tax that's ever been offered. It would be an enormous tax cut. We'll argue that money's better spent here at home and less money in Washington. The other thing we do is something that's never been done before. We take the payroll tax and roll it into the business tax. So businesses will pay the payroll tax, not the individual. What does that mean? It means if you make $40,000 a year and you're married and have two kids, you'll no longer pay FICA. Your employer will pay the FICA. It's about $2,000 reduction in taxes for everybody that makes $40,000 a year. This would be something that would be an enormous stimulus to the economy. Nobody else is offering this. In Washington, what passes for bold is revenue neutral tax reform. So what I'd say is we need to be boldly for what we are for. I want to be part of that. I think it can be a revolution in our country. We need to choose a nominee that can expand the party to encompass the entire Bill of Rights, including the right to privacy. I want to be that candidate, and I hope you'll help me. Thank you very much. Thank you.